Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, welcome to the Ollie Steele Show. I got started just a little bit late here tonight, but hopefully everything is streaming properly. It says it's not, but hopefully we're on. Tonight we're going to, we have an interview with Charles Bonner, who wrote the bracelet. And Charles is a civil rights attorney for the last 30 years. Lives out in San Francisco, but he's been involved with prosecuting a number, or I should say, not prosecuting, but defending a number of victims of child slavery, and in the United States and in around the world. His book is called The Bracelet. And it's available on Amazon and bookstores. It's a fascinating interview with him tonight, and that'll come up around about 8:30. In the meantime, I wanted to I got some interesting stuff that I wanted to talk about tonight. I'm going to go to I got started just a bit late here tonight, so. And I wanted to read some news. There's been a lot of things happening recently that I think should be talked about. And I'm going to do just that in just a second here. This is kind of interesting. This came up today, and anti-Zionist Jews met Ahmadinejad in a New York hotel today. This came up today. Something we're never allowed to see in the Zionist-owned U.S. mainstream media. This meeting occurred between Ahmadinejad on September 2009, his trip to New York. And I think it's kind of interesting. I thought there was an article to this, just a bunch of pictures. But this is kind of an interesting thing. To the hold on a second here, I'm just trying to. Something that came up as GM crops cause liver and kidney damage. A report published in the International Journal of Microbiology has verified once again that Monsanto's genetically modified crops are causing severe health problems. A legal challenge issued against Monsanto forced the multinational agricultural giant to release raw data revealing the animals fed its patented GM corn suffered liver and kidney damage within just 3 months. And I'm going to read that article because I think it's quite critical. This is from naturalnews.com. Great site, by the way. Adding to the mounting evidence that GM crops are dangerous all around, this information provides a damning indictment against Monsanto, which continually insists that its GM crops are safe. Not only are GM crops proving disastrous for the environment, but study after study, including those conducted by Monsanto itself, is showing that GM foods are detrimental to health. Monsanto data indicated that the company had conducted tests on three varieties of its GM corn, two of which contained the dangerous BT protein, and one designed specifically to resist Monsanto's Roundup herbicide. All three are widely grown in the United States, while only one is currently grown in Europe. Dr. Gilles Eric Seralini, a French researcher from the University of Cannes, was tasked with examining the data and providing a review. While stopping short of declaring GM crops to be toxic, He did emphasize that chronic negative effects were apparent and that there were statistically significant indications of kidney and liver damage. A significant effect observed in test rats included a buildup of hormones in the blood, indicating that their liver and kidneys were not functioning properly. One variety of the corn fed to elevated blood sugar levels and increased triglyceride levels in female rats given it. Dr. Seralini concluded that because GM crops are foreign substances that have never been a part of a normal diet, there is no telling what the long-term effects of consumption will be on people. In animals, significant disruption of normal bodily function has been observed even in the short term. Genetically manipulated food crops are not fit for human consumption and should not be classified as food. No legitimate study has even ever proven them to be safe or nutritious. The burden of proof is on the producers of such crops to verify their safety, and to date, all data has revealed that they are unsafe. Claims that GM foods will end world hunger are baseless and propagated only by those that have a final interest in converting the world's food supply to their own patented varieties and control in order to control it. I think that says kind of enough about that. But I refuse to touch anything that is even remotely associated with Monsanto, especially Roundup or any kind of processed foods, especially corn products. Fortunately, even the corn products are genetically modified. All of them are genetically modified foods, products. Kellogg's was criticized for using genetically modified corn and wheat products, and in their cereals. And they said that they weren't about to stop, and that was their final word. And I hope the hell Kellogg's goes to hell, personally. And before it kills everybody and goes out of business. Horrible companies. Let's see. Well, pretty much everybody's heard about the Pope's perversion, and I think this article will say enough about it. Convenient media is a rope-a-dope with the Pope. This came out Wednesday, today. Yes, the Pope is a perverse and ironic cartoon, but all this information we are hearing has been out there for a long, long time. It is breaking now because cosmic forces, for those of you who believe in such things, have demanded it. It is breaking because certain vested interests who control the media want the church destroyed so that they can continue in their efforts to destroy Christianity and to bestialize and enslave humanity. Is it a combination of both without the latter knowing this? Because it doesn't believe it in the former. I don't know who wrote this. I'll guarantee it's Rents or something. Yeah, Smoking Mirrors. All right. It's annoying as hell. This site annoys me too often. I am sorry that I went to it. It's really more of a joke site and a conspiracy site. And I really kind of dislike it. Going through this here. Let's see. This might make some sense. This is from Global Research, CA. Western civilization and the economic crisis, impoverishment of the middle class. When empire hits home, this is part two of a two-part series. But part one as racism and the empire of poverty. But I think it's kind of interesting to go, maybe I shouldn't. Western nations of the world have built their great wealth and societies on the exploitation and plundering of the people and resources of the rest of the world. The wealth, freedom, and structures of our societies have been built on the starvation, robbery, deprivation, and murder of millions upon millions of world's people, both historically and presently. It seems for a time that Western civilization had worked, even if only for the West. We saw the emergence and growth of a vibrant middle class, which has its origins in the Industrial Revolution, out of which we also saw the formation of the nuclear family. The middle classes of the West grew in wealth, education, and access, while the great problems of the world and for the majority of the world's people persisted and expanded exponentially, and the great purpose of the middle class was siphoned and expanded into facilitating the development of massive consumerist society. The function of the middle class became that of consuming, not necessarily contributing to determining the direction of society. Very well, that's very poignant, and I think well said. Nevertheless, life was good, or so it seemed. Thus, the people were by and large able to turn a blind eye to the plight of the world's majority. As the decades progressed, however, the great Western empires, increasingly united under the umbrella of a U.S.-led NATO empire, grossly expanded their plundering and exploitation of the rest of the world. New avenues for capitalist expansion needed to be found, more money to be made, more assets to be owned, and more power to be had. As a part of this process, class structure was being reorganized, which meant that the middle class was to undergo an evolution. In the past few decades, the middle class has been forced to survive on debt. In order to maintain the image of middle class and to maintain the functions of the middle class, i.e. to consume, the middle class needed access to credit and had to descend into a class of debt. Now, as the world is undergoing a rapid social, political, and economic transformation, the middle class has been marked for death. As a debt crisis takes the nation of the world into debt servitude, the middle classes of the Western world will lose their access to credit and will be forced into repaying their debts. As nations fall under a debt crisis, the middle class will collapse with it. A class built and sustained on debt is not sustainable. We are entering into a period of rapid class transformation on a global scale. The mirage of the middle class is steadily vanishing as our eyes adjust to the reality of our environment. The empire we turned a blind eye to abroad is about to hit home. What we do abroad comes home to roost. The middle class is about to realize the true cost of empire. The debt class. In 1958, the first successful modern credit card was launched by Bank America, eventually evolving into what we know as Visa. And the origins of MasterCard date back to 1966. The expansion of credit card usage grew exponentially through the following decades. In 2004, PBS published a special report on the secret history of credit cards. One of the researchers explained that the most magical convenience of plastic money is critical to our famously compulsive consumer economy. As with more than 641 million credit cards in circulation and accounting for an estimated $1.5 trillion of consumer spending, the U.S. economy has clearly gone plastic. However, credit card companies do not seek as an ideal customer, the one who pays off their cards on a monthly basis. The industry's most profitable customers, the ones being sought by creative marketing tactics, are the revolvers, the estimated 115 million Americans who carry monthly credit card debt. That's one-third, folks. That's over one-third of the American public carries a monthly credit card debt. And some experts say that the profitability of credit cards really began 25 years ago in 1979, when the banking industry successfully eliminated a critical restriction, the limit on the interest rate a lender can charge or borrow. Deregulation, coupled with a revolution in technology that enables the most real-time tracking of personal financial information and emergence of nationwide banking, has facilitated the widening availability of credit cards across the economic spectrum. but for some the cost of credit is often far greater than it appears. Robert McKinley, founder and chairman of CardWeb.com and RAM Research, a payment card research firm, explained that banks are raising interest rates, adding new fees, making the due dates for your payments a holiday or a Sunday on the hopes that maybe you'll trip up and get a payment in late, and thus it becomes a very anti-consumer marketplace. It was in the origins of the neoliberal era in the 1980s that the West saw the ascendancy of credit cards. The neoliberal era, that was in more the neoconservative era, the Margaret Thatcher and, whatever his face was, Ronald Reagan and all the conservatives. They were not conservatives in their spending, though. While the Western nations of the world in collusion and international banks and corporations plundered the Third World through structural adjustments at the behest of the World Bank and the IMF, the middle class of the Western world were lulled into a debt trap from which they would not emerge. Between 1980 and 1990, now, those were the Reagan and Bush years, by the way, if anybody remembers. Okay, and Margaret Thatcher years. A number of credit cards more than doubled. Okay, but in 1979, when the banking industry eliminated critical restriction, that was under Jimmy Carter, all right? And when we were suffering from, 21% inflation rates and stuff, I mean, it was absolutely insane. But I take homage with this... With this guy's facts, but I'll continue. In 1994, Federal Reserve figures in the United States showed that middle-class families remained stuck with unusually high debt payments as a portion of their income. The New York Times reported that high debt resulting from the stagnating wages while low interest rates have encouraged families to borrow means consumers are living close to the financial edge and ready to cut spending at any sign of economic trouble. One prominent economist even stated that the rate of consumer spending is not sustainable unless there is a noticeable pickup in the pace of income growth. That has not occurred. In 2006, a major report released by a U.S. think tank revealed, I wish you mentioned who it was, I hope it's not the Heritage Group or the monkeys from the American Enterprise Institute, but the middle class today is less prepared for an economic emergency, such as losing a job or visiting an emergency room, than at any time since the late 70s. And the report published 2 years before the outbreak of the global financial crisis reported that, despite a growing economy, a rising stock market, and stronger corporate earnings that are helping the rich get richer, the middle class in America is caught in an unprecedented squeeze that makes it increasingly unstable. Among the conclusions of the report, it was revealed that income for middle class families has remained stagnant or flat since 2001, while prices for big-ticket items, house, healthcare, college education, transportation, have skyrocketed, leaving families unable to save. Thus, middle-class families are borrowing record amounts of money to pay their monthly bills. And one of the lead research economists in the think tank said that families are being forced to live beyond their means just to pay the basics. And blah, 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 blah. We all know this. Usually this page is usually good. Global Research is a credible group, and I'm sure that he's done some research. But it bothers me that he won't name the think tank, maybe because he's a member. But also there's a lot of errors in this report that I can already see. So. I have to disagree with much of what he says here. So I'm going to dispense with this article, and if you want to read it, it's rather lengthy and it's a two-parter. But you go to globalresearch.ca, and I think you'll have enough. It's true that the economic situation is bad, really bad. But it's also, and run amok like that. Any idiot can tell you that. But you know, as the way out and what brought us in there. And it's been for, you know, 20, 25 years of Republican wars and Republican tax cuts and you know, corporate greed and credit card insanity. And I have to blame Joe Biden and, you know, Chris Dodd and all the other assholes of integrity or lack of integrity, okay, that have caused this incredible breach in trust and possibly the downfall of the American economy. And, you know, unfortunately, we're not in the 7th to the 18th century when our heads would roll, but it would be a very good thing. I'm going to... there's one other article that I wanted to read tonight. I don't know if we'll have time to do that. But I think it's... I was trying to read it last night on our show, and we just kind of... kind of went around it. We read parts of it. But it's a very good article. And it's by Rents.com. And you can get it there. It's up there. It was written on the 29th. I believe, I'm sure it's still posted there. I see it here. And it's called Haiti Post-Quake Devastation, Deprivation, Exploitation, and Oppression. And it says 2.5 months post-quake, the major media mostly ignore Haiti. The calamitous condition on the ground and the growing desperation of millions forced to largely endure on their own, out of sight, mind, and concern of the world leaders and UN, USAID, and other aid organizations diverting most of the $700 million plus donated to contractors and profiteering NGOs. In March 11th, New York Times editorial entitled Haiti 2 months Later tried to have it both ways, citing relief efforts' failures, yet praising the U.S., UN, foreign countries, and aid organizations for dispatching tents, tarps, food, water, medicine, and doctors as they should. They have done a lot of good, particularly in the United States, which rushed supplies, a U.S. force, and hospital ships. Many lives are saved. That's a quote from the Times. But unmentioned was the thousands of U.S. combat troops obstructing aid, getting none to the most impoverished neighborhoods, and amount of emergency shelters have been woefully inadequate, making calamitous conditions worse. In March 25th, Times editorial, Haiti Misery, in fact, admitted it, stating, "The emergency in Haiti isn't over. It's getting worse as the outside world attention fades away. Yet misery rages like a fever in the hundreds of camps sheltering hundreds of thousands of people left homeless, and the dreaded rains have swamped tents and ragged stick tarp huts. They have turned some walkways into mud lakes, exacerbating the problem of cooking food, washing clothes, staying clean, and avoiding disease. It's the plight of about 1.3 million and no shelter, proper sanitation, clean water, enough food, and medical care. On March 4th, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention raised concerns about a potentially deadly malaria outbreak. Besides numerous other diseases now spreading, on March 5th, Partners in Health, PIH, called conditions on the ground shameful, shocking, inhumane, and rapidly deteriorating. Excuse me. Daily they worsen, placing millions of Haitians in grave peril of calamitous deprivation, deadly diseases, greater pain and suffering, and potential mass deaths, because imperial plans for Haiti are to plunder it for profit and control, not help desperately needy people, many of whom will suffer and die. Haiti is open for business. What no longer exists, reconstruction will be profit-driven, replacing former neighborhoods with gentrified ones, corporate ventures, and other upscale projects. Poor Haitians being dispossessed, exploited, neglected, abandoned, and oppressed if they resist, especially if they interfere with the planned plunder of Haiti, his oil, and other resources. On March 24th, George W. Bush and Bill Clinton, you know, the two biggest assholes that ever walked the face of the earth, visited Port-au-Prince with René Préval, feigned concern, and participated in staged refuge camp photo ops. Haitians reacted angrily, especially at Bush for ousting President Jean Bertrand Aristide in 2004, exiling him to South Africa and preventing his return. Now more than ever, he is needed. Protesters outside the National Palace burned tires and an American flag, shouting, "Return Aristide, down with Preval, down with Bush." The Miami Herald described the Champ de Mars refugee camps visiting, saying, quake survivors screamed at the three leaders, shouting details of the losses they suffered. Others took a moment to criticize their own president's leadership. "President Preval has never come to see us before," screamed Marlene Saint Louis, who lives in the place Mausolée camp the president visited. "Now, because Bush is here, he comes. Now he wants to see us." The trip served two purposes: to increase interest for March 31st New York International Investment Conference, which is today expected to approve an $11.5 billion package to solidify corporate control of the country, and for Preval to resolve land issues obstructing quake survivor relocations from areas wanted for commercial redevelopment to Haitians have to go willingly or by force. Haitians are on their own. Women and children most vulnerable, according to Amnesty International. A March 25th report said sexual violence is widely present in the camps where some of Haiti's most vulnerable live. It was already a major concern, but the situation in which displaced people are living exposes women and girls to even greater risks. Most victims, all interviewed, were minors. One 8-year-old girl was raped when alone in her tent at night. A 15-year-old girl was raped when she went out of the camp to urinate. And there are no shelters in the country where victims of sexual violence can be protected and have access to services. From March 4th to the 25th, AI assessed conditions in quake-struck areas, in particular human rights abuses affecting women and children. They reported mass displacement, makeshift camps on every plot of empty land, public or private, in every space, square and football pitch. Even a golf course and secondary roads were used. Within the camps, security is non-existent, except for scattered ad hoc efforts, leaving women and girls most vulnerable, as well as everyone, to theft or assaults that might cost them their lives. AI visited camps with no emergency shelter, food, sanitation, water, or medical care, saying living conditions in these camps are dire and the majority of inhabitants are deeply frustrated with the Haitian authorities and international agencies showing no concern for their condition. The Latin American Solidarity Coalition's assessment on the ground pre-quake states that is an association of national and local U.S.-based grassroots, not yet, in support of people of Latin America struggling for justice and better future for their countries, free of economic, military, and cultural imperialism. From December 28, 2009, January 7, 2010, 5 days before the quake, its 11-member delegation visited Haiti to investigate UN's Blue Helmet human rights abuses. On returning, it published a report entitled "Haiti in a Press State." Its highlights reviewed below. LASC met with over 70 individuals and organization representatives in Port-au-Prince and two of the most impoverished neighborhoods. It also spent 2 days in Jacmel visiting sustainable development projects. Testimonies from this organization, the UN, inflicted violence victims were forgotten. Testimonies from MINUSTAH, inflicted violence victims were gotten. In other words, the UN Blue Helmet guys were inflicting violence on people, and they took testimonies, including people whose family members were murdered, and that's virtually everyone, demanded Aristide's return, called the UN a repressive criminal force, said the international aid hasn't reached the poor, but instead has been diverted to predatory NGOs, prison building or stolen by corrupt politicians, and believed economic development is exploitive, not providing a living wage or benefiting poor Haitians productively. The story is long, painful, and familiar. For over 200 years and 300 before that, the U.S., France, and Western Europe actively bled and exploited Haitians and prevented the only nation born of a slave revolt from becoming successful. It endured military invasions, economic embargoes, gunboats, blockades, trade barriers, diplomatic quarantines, subsidized arms subversions, U.S. armed-backed dictators, and finally two U.S.-supported coups against its only beloved leader since liberation, twice democratically elected overwhelmingly, and now exiled and kept from returning. Repeatedly, people said, "We want Pavel to send President Aristide a passport. If Obama wants that to happen, it will, because Pavel takes his orders from the powerful nations, representing hope, Aristide value, social justice, and would be an inspiration to the grassroots majorities. When he was president, there were more jobs, health care, and education for our children. No longer since 2004, Pavel's 2006 election. They don't hear our demands for better education, health care, better roads, and end of malnutrition. Where does the international aid go? We don't see it. Pavel is weak and corrupt. We want him to listen to us. We want the return of Aristide, and Pavel should change and not exclude Lavalas." Pavel was complicit in the 2004 coup, then allied with the Washington installed interim Latorre government to prevent Aristide's return after a more people-oriented 1996 to 2001 term. So post-quake, he's been pathetic, inept, and indifferent to his people's plight, largely invisible, out of sight, silent, and on the sidelines when he most needed. Public anger toward him is palatable. From one Haitian, he's the devil, and we don't want him anymore. His prospects for a third term are likely nil. He himself saying in a radio interview, "I don't do politics, okay?" Former opposition figure Evan Pauls accused him of single-handedly showing the Haitian people that he cannot lead them. And the UN, the problem, not the UN is the problem and not the solution. It was established on June 1st, 2004, for an initial, MINUSTAH, arm of the UN military. It was established on June 1st, 2004, for an initial 6 months renewable period to promote interaction with Haitian authorities as partners of cooperating under the following mandate: in support of the traditional government to ensure a secure and stable environment within which the constitution and political process in Haiti can take place, and it was to assist the restoration and so on and so forth. But since 2004, the only human rights violations are by the UN. This was stated by a Haiti Liberté journalist, Yves Perret Louis. And he said the only human rights violations are by the UN. And they break into houses and kill people. They shot into a protest by students. At Jean Jass' funeral, the UN shot a mourner. People from the Central Plateau were demonstrating for electricity, and the UN killed two of them. They commit rape and sexual abuse. They steal peasants, goats, and they protect the elite from terrorizing the population. Another Set Soleil resident said, "Now that there are no bandits, the UN are the bandits. If they search you and find jewelry, they steal it. They make women take off their clothes to humiliate them." Other accounts accused UN forces of shooting up a market, killing and wounding people there. Nigerian soldiers beating a man so severely he nearly died, and no investigation conducted of these or other incidents when demanded. The case of the human rights activist Levinsky Pierre Antoine is shocking and disturbing, and after announcing his 2007 Senate candidacy and participating in sit-ins announcing UN human rights violations, he was disappeared without a trace. Lavalas organizer René Seville said the occupation is killing and humiliating the people. At any time, it could explode into a revolt. And the UN has incited the people to be violent. They live and eat well while we are hungry, homeless, and without schools. If not for the UN guns, Haiti would already have its freedom. Haiti's dysfunctional judicial system lacks investigated four areas: lack of legal recourse and legal limbo. that prison conditions are horrible. And activists, when they took away Levinsky, his prominence was his undoing. And speculated that his abductors don't intend to release him. Perhaps he's dead in efforts to learn the truth have been stonewalled. Haitian elections are a joke, and predatory NGOs are exploiting the entire country. And the economy is 80, the poorest, hemisphere's poorest nation, 80% of its population is deeply impoverished. That malnutrition is rampant. And the result is a vulnerable population, most on small subsistence farms, others easily exploited in corporate-run sweatshops. And the kinds Bush and Clinton want more of, as well as a sweeping privatization, tourism, port development, free trade zones, and deregulatory freedom-creating worker hell. Besides unmentioned resource development, the benefits solely for business, not people. Haitian oligarchs control local agricultural industry and cheap imports, privatization, poor infrastructure, slave wages, too few jobs, and management co-opted unions control Haiti, exploited people deprived of their rights. Then he goes on. I'm going to refer you to this article because there's quite a bit more to it. But it's on rents.com. And it's an excellent article. Haiti post-quake devastation, deprivation, exploitation, and oppression. Let's go to rents.com. And we're going to go back to, at this point, I'm going to go back to our... our interview tonight with Charles Bonner, civil rights attorney and author of The Bracelet, and it's an expose or it's a novel basically based on truth, a true story, and of an abduction of a number of women that he represented, and. Well, he'll talk about it and that, but also about the novel, but more so we get into the severity of the child slavery and child and women slavery in this country, sex slavery in around the world and in this country. And I hope you enjoy the interview. It starts a little quickly here, but you'll catch up with it. Here we go. It's about 30 minutes.
Having to use their bodies to... try to liberate themselves, and often they are not successful.
So who does profit from this industry besides the joy of these individuals that have kidnapped them?
Well, we are talking about a sex ring of various organized groups mm-hmm. who are involved in this sex human trafficking around the world. They don't really have a particular name. You can't say, well, it's the mafia or it's this group, because there are various loosely organized individuals or groups of individuals who are involved in this trade, and they're just bringing girls out from around the world and selling them like cattle.
Now it's been known for many years, or at least I've read of it for many years, about the European sex trade. With a great deal of child pornography and child sex rings and so on and so forth. And oddly enough, in certain countries like in Germany and others that you hear these about these this tremendous amount of incest, okay, that happens, and a lot of child abuses. Do you get that have you found that in your research? I've seen this for years and read about it in a number of different places, but a good author, David Icke, has reported that for many years.
Incest is one of the ancient forms of child abuse.
Mm-hmm.
It's not one of the types that is a part of the money making aspect, the really despicable type.
No, but it leads to that kind of thing. I mean, they sell them off, or they just they prep them for and victims of that. Wind up in the sex trades, a lot of them.
Absolutely, because, these children are left with unhealable wounds, wounds
right.
that are
right.
left gaping open forever, for the rest of their lives. You only need to ask, say, a 90-year-old woman who was abused as a child, and if she tells you about it, she will tear up. There is no healing. And that is the basic question. And are we as a society failing to prepare our children on how to deal with these crimes? And really, the answer is yes, we are failing as a society. There's no protection, there's no advocates. For example, we hear about war on crimes. We hear war on drugs, war on terrorism, war on everything. But have you heard of a war on child sex slavery? Not until this book, The Bracelet, because this main character, Macy, much like Harriet Tubman led a war against slavery by running the slaves out of the South to freedom, she goes around the globe and frees victims. But she educates us to what is going on. She elevates our awareness to this despicable crime on these helpless victims. So that was the purpose of this book, is to try to show parents how these predators work. They educate all of us, law enforcement, the church, but particularly parents, that we can protect our children, but we have to be more vigilant. We have to better prepare the children to resist child sex slavery. Right now, I mean, they have programs about DARE and all of this for the evils of drugs. But, you know, here, this guy involved in the case in Syracuse, he went around and scoped out young girls who appeared to be homeless, appeared to be from one family homes, and then he would kidnap them. He would find the people who were very marginal, the girls who you would say are marginal girls in society. In other words, he didn't look at the daughters of mayors and politicians. He went to those kids in the ghetto. This particular guy was an equal opportunity molester in that he kidnapped first a Native American girl, held her for 3 years, and he kidnapped a Hispanic girl, a Vietnamese, an Irish girl, and then he kidnapped an African American girl. So he was an equal opportunity molester, predator.
I found I don't know if you must have run across this, but in I found on there's an organization right now an Indian organization, American Indian organization, that is trying to bring attention to exactly this problem. But how many the children on their reservations are being stolen? Okay.
Yes.
And being kidnapped and being put into slavery, or they don't know, but because of the horrible conditions on those reservations, the kids are, you know,
vulnerable,
very vulnerable. Then they're offering them money, or they're offering them, you know, whatever, and they're taking them, and they never see them again. And there's a Stop the Theft of American Indian Women.
Yeah, this is the we as a human race, as a species, must take on it, and we must end it. And I would like to see it ended by 2012 in the same way we ended slavery, same way that we ended this discrimination against women. Women couldn't vote, they couldn't own property.
But in your book, you constantly bring up the predator being very wealthy men, very wealthy organizations of men in Japan and India and Europe and so on, who run these stuff and these sex rings, all right?
Yes.
And I mean, this is a very well financed, very well organized.
It involves the status of women in those countries. The status of women in those countries historically has not been very high, and men have had all the power.
Well, you're absolutely correct, and in society in general. But you know, that is a recent phenomenon. That if we look at the span of human existence, which is about 3 million years, and we look at it, say, we analogize it to the span of the United States from San Francisco to New York, the last 10,000 years is from, say, the beginning of the Brooklyn Bridge heading west, that we have had this kind of disrespect of women. for the other, particularly 40,000 years before Christ, every culture worshipped women as goddesses. They had women as a part of our theology of spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
But then something happened with our culture. We lost our way when we shifted to the he god, the father god. You know, all hell broke loose, and this disrespect of women and consequently children then went on the rise. And we see that throughout history, the kind of disrespect, the witches, the witch burning, and all the other disrespect of children and women. And so what the bracelet attempts to do is to reacquaint us with who we are as human beings, that this is not who we are as men. We have a better, a higher self than to mistreat women and disrespect women. And but it's a matter of elevating our consciousness. And particularly this book attempts to teach everyone how to avoid allowing these kids to be kidnapped, how to teach kids to outsmart these sex slavers and teach them how to survive. Many of these kids don't survive.
Mm-hmm.
It also seeks to teach kids and parents how a sexual predator thinks before an abduction and after an abduction. Many of these crimes really are not about sex. It's about power and money.
Mm-hmm.
And so the problem is that we have not really had a dialogue, and that's why I'm quite honored that you all would air this particular topic, because it hasn't been discussed like all these other crimes, you know, like terrorism and
mm-hmm.
drugs.
Such a fundamental crime. It hits at the heart of who we are as a people.
What bothers me is you see it all over the place. It's all over the news. People, you know, pedophilia this and pedophilia that. And
it's certainly been brought up with the problems in the Catholic Church.
Now you got the entire Catholic Church is unbelievable. And I just read an article today that they're demanding the Pope resign over this because he was involved up to his eyeballs with the latest
in protecting these people.
And protecting them. So, but it's like it just seems that there's so much more of it than ever before.
Do you think that's true?
Just let me finish. There is an unnatural fixation that this country, and probably, I don't know if it's as prevalent in Europe, but this country, pedophilia. Paranoid, like unbelievable, like crazy. I mean, every time you turn on the TV set, you got, you know, somebody else has been abducted and some other problem. You got total shows on, like Mary Grace or Nancy Grace or whatever that. I mean, every time you turn that show on, I mean, all she does is spend an hour just talking about sex offenders.
But they don't talk about the part that's so important is how to protect children.
No, they don't.
We should do to educate ourselves and educate the public, and I think that's the most important part instead of sensationalizing it.
They talk about the crime and the sensation of the crime and the victims and so on, but they never talk about preventing this, and they never go beyond it as to what's causing it.
Well, that's precisely, you're absolutely correct, both of you, that the key issue is how do we protect children?
That's right.
The second key issue is what is the solution to this? And frankly, when we look at the solution, we men have to re-examine the ways in which we relate to women. We have to really apologize to women for the abuse that we've heaped upon them for generations and ask for forgiveness and start over with a new, renewed respect for women and include them, include women as a part of our theology, include the divine feminine. Once we begin to rethink, we have this paradigm shift in our thinking and the way we view women.
This is interesting because how are you going to possibly get a patriarchal religion? Okay, Catholicism, Islam, Judaism. I mean, all of these.
Those are the three major religions to
accept. The goddess, when they consider that all of this pagans, I mean, you listen to all these wingnut religious groups talking about paganism and the worship of the goddess and this and that is all devil worship and stuff like this. I mean, some of these groups would actually, start burning witches again. I mean, you know, people from witchcraft.
Gotta be careful.
So it's like, how do you possibly change that mindset
you know, of 2 or 3 or 4 thousand years of patriarchal consciousness and patriarchal religions.
Yes, you changed it, Leo, by doing exactly what you and your co-hosts are doing, talking about the subject, talking about the various goddesses that exist throughout history, talking about the fact that we are better human beings than the way in which we're behaving, talking about the fact that this rampant pedophilia is just unleashing us in society that are not healed. They haven't had any job training, they haven't had any health care training, they haven't had therapy. They all suffer. Oh.
Hello, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. I thought we lost you there for a minute.
No,
okay.
They've all of these victims have suffered post-traumatic stress disorder,
yeah.
And without any medical treatment for this problem, they then, many of them, become predators themselves. They go out and commit crime because they're trying to medicate their own pain. So this pedophilia, there's a lot of evidence that it's incurable. You put these people in jail, you let them out, they're gonna commit another crime.
That's
well,
true.
Here's an excellent example.
High recidivism rate with that.
Right, here's an example of what happened recently. Tonight, actually, I was watching, I think it was CNN or something, and they had a Dalit woman, you know, who, you mentioned that in your book, actually. She's untouchable. And but this woman was like 32 years old, and she was unmarried. And in this particular story, and she
in India,
and her father, her mother passed away, but her mother wanted her to get educated and wanted, but her father kept her locked up in her house. Okay, when she applied to a college and got accepted, her father refused to let her go and beat her, right, and insisted that she remain
illiterate.
Like, and her mother was illiterate. However, she demanded that and of course she got, and she was late, she died. The tragedy of that was, here was a 32-year-old woman who was fighting this system pretty much by herself, as one of the untouchables in the Indian society. How can you possibly change that kind of mentality? Even in a matter of a decade or a century. Okay.
Yeah, we have to just get our teaspoon, get to the base of the mountain, and keep digging and digging until we make that change.
Yeah,
we have to write about it, and that's why I wrote about it. I've handled many of these cases over 30 years, and it just goes on and on. It gets more. It seemed to be getting worse. Every day.
Do you think the internet has contributed to this problem?
Excuse me?
Do you think the internet has, the availability of pornography and the ability to network worldwide and the internet has contributed to this problem?
Well, most definitely. It's contributed in two ways. One, it has made it easier for people to engage in this kind of perversion, but more importantly, it has been the vehicle to allow these predators access to these children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you read all the time where a predator goes online and lures a 12-year-old girl or a 12-year-old boy into this despicable conduct. And also, as a third way the internet has exacerbated this problem, is allowing those who benefit financially, that $10 billion per year crowd, has allowed them to use the internet to conduct this trade and to conduct it internationally. So
right.
The internet certainly has exacerbated the problem, but at the same time, the internet is just a tool. It can also help us end child sex slavery in the world. And I would like to see us push to end it by 2012. I would like to make that declaration that we're going to push to protect our children and end child sex slavery in the world by 2012.
Well, here is one of the biggest problems that I see. I mean, here you have the UN, which should be the International Monetary Agency. Okay. To enact this kind of thing, and you have complaints all over the world. We just read one from Haiti, but you have
complaints from all over the world of them being the most greatest offenders of this child sex slavery ring.
That they're engaged in really poor behavior when they go in to supposedly create a safety net for the people and for the countries, the countries can't prosecute those people. They're immune from prosecution.
So basically, I mean, they got an open field.
That's the real problem
for these actions, and you know, and they have been condemned and prosecuted and shown that some of them have been, and internationally they've proven that these guys are operating sex rings and kidnapping squads and so on. They're just out of the UN.
Yes, well, you clearly, Leo, have read my book, and you know I address the need to have a UN world patrol force, a police force to protect women and children around the world.
Well, I think that, I mean, personally, I don't know about you, but I think the UN is one huge corrupt agency.
Well,
right?
That
and
may
it's
be
proven
so,
itself,
but
kind of
we,
continually
as a society, must deal with corruption by enacting tough ethic laws, but at the same time, we must use the existing apparatuses that we have to end and combat this scourge in society, combat child
and,
sex
and
slavery.
Who's gonna,
I think, for example, we should, in the UN, we should pass an international law to make it a crime against humanity to harm a child.
This is the same, but the problem is that this is the same organization that passed a resolution to commit genocide in Iraq and Afghanistan and Gaza and every other place, okay? So to trust the UN to do anything, okay, to help humanity is an absolute delusion, okay? And I think you have to get, you know, I think you have to get people like yourself who are absolutely committed to doing this and give them some kind of, autonomy in the prosecution of these things and power. All right. That's the only way to do this.
And your hosts, we all, those of us who are conscious and aware and believe that this can end. I mean, look at slavery. Slavery went on in this country, transatlantic slave trade from 1619 to 1865.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, there were good people like you all that say, no, this is wrong. This is a crime against humanity, and they did not let up, even though it was against all odds.
Well, the abolitionists, I praise those guys. You can't believe. I mean, the courage and tenacity and
Look at us as a species. Every species on the planet, from a chicken to a giraffe, protects their young at the peril of their own life, except us. We will go out and sell a 10-year-old girl for a bag of rice, as they do in Thailand. And I'm on my way to Thailand right now to investigate this this issue. I've gone to Japan. I've gone to many of the countries that I write about, Brazil, many of the countries that I write about in the book. And this is a problem that we as a society must tackle, and we must come up with strategic plans. For example, we need, I think, a one-strike rule. You harm a child, you go into jail forever. Only way you could possibly get out is you demonstrate that you no longer threat to society, and then there should be a ankle bracelet that will monitor your conduct, and likewise, we should wipe out a statute of limitation. There should not be a statute of limitation for harming a child, the same way there's no statute of limitation for murder. So that if you harm a child, you go into jail, and if you get away, we will hunt you down until we find you, and then we will prosecute you. In other words, we must have a zero tolerance.
I have to question that only in one respect, okay? Not that I don't agree with you on a strict prosecution, but the statute of limitations thing is very bizarre, and I'm questioning this in the church prosecutions, where guys come back 25, 35, 40 years later and say, I've been molested. Okay, I was molested when I was 10 or something, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, that kind of stretches the
You're always going to get people that are going to take advantage of a situation. But I think he's absolutely right. There should be no statute of limitation on a child taken advantage of. I agree with that.
And what constitutes a molestation? And you know, because we're going to be seeing a whole lot of trials going on with a church.
Well, they've tried to bury him.
I
have represented a 33-year-old man who was molested by his pastor. This was not in the Catholic Church, and when he was 14 years old, and we proved that it happened. The problem is, again, once this happens, the integrity of the child is so threatened. It confuses them, and that confusion and that pain never goes away. They literally become shackled in this pain and in this shame until they can get some healing, and they can't get healing until there's some kind of justice.
Right.
So that's why there shouldn't be a statute of limitation. You may have read just recently a 54-year-old man and a 50-year-old man came forward and said they were molested by some priest.
Yes.
Women come forward. These people are not coming forward for any kind of self-aggrandizement. It is so humiliating to come forward. I have seen the humiliation. I've been in deposition with young girls who've been molested by another woman. In case of a basketball coach who I represented. I've been in cases with boys who just are so ashamed they can't look up to talk about this, even though it happened 5 or 6 years before. So that's what we're dealing with. But the real reason why this is important to us as a society is that these wounded people are walking around. They are walking wounded. And then they become a liability to all of us. And so we have, a responsibility, social responsibility, to take care of them on the one hand, to treat them, to get them skills, to get their therapy, but on the other hand, and most importantly, to prevent this from happening to them in the first place. And that's why we have to teach our parents and children how to avoid being a victim of a sexual predator.
Right. There was an article I pulled up. I was going to read tonight, but it was on this. I don't know where it is. Here it is. About this conservative Mexican priest. It just came out today, actually, in the last couple of days. About this Reverend Marshall Marcel. There's a picture of him. He blessed by the Pope in 2004. But what he did, he was the head of the Legion of Christ. Turned out that he fathered at least one child, molested seminarians and boys, and is said to have boasted that he had the Pope's permission to get massages from young nuns. All right? He's getting blessed by Pope John Paul II in this picture. All right? So, but this was something that just came up, and his own sons. Said that he continually molested them.
Okay. Oh, my Lord.
So, I mean, this is the problem.
This is who we are as human beings.
But this guy is the head of the Legions of Christ.
Well, he was in a position of power. He also raised a lot of money.
Yes.
And he could take advantage of people because a priest to Catholics, especially uneducated Catholics, is a very powerful figure.
But my question to you, Charles, is this. I mean, with this kind of activity going on within the Catholic Church, I would be as an investigator, as I would be investigating these guys for sex ring as a sex ring. I mean, I would be looking at the Vatican. I would be looking right at Pope Ratzinger. All right, I'd be looking at all of these guys.
They are looking at them.
I know they are, but what I'm trying to say is that I mean that's where. Sounds to me like there may be a serious sex ring going on there, right in the Vatican.
Well,
to accommodate all the cardinals and all the happy Catholics there.
Well, yeah, we certainly do not want to speculate about a lot of the charges that have not been proven. But
this one was proven.
Any proven act of molestation should be dealt with in the same way any other. The person should go to jail.
Yeah.
I represented a young 12-year-old boy who was molested by a scoutmaster, and then the scoutmaster went to San Quentin for 14 years. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, as I mentioned, I represented a young, beautiful basketball coach, female, who molested almost an entire team of girls.
Wow.
She just did an ankle bracelet for a year. There's an unequal prosecution. There's selective prosecutions of these cases.
But now, and you represented her. Okay.
No, I represented her victim.
Her victims. Okay.
I represented the victims that she molested.
Right.
So.
Was it because she was a woman that she was dealt with more leniently?
Well, yes. You saw the woman down in Florida who molested a 13-year-old boy in her class. She was a teacher.
That's
right.
The judge said she was too pretty to go to jail. So we need an even prosecution, whether you are the Pope, or you the judge, or you are the, you know, whatever your standard in life is, you molest a child, you go to jail. This uneven discriminatory prosecution is what allows this crime to continue. We, in society, becomes enablers to crippling our young, the most precious asset we as a human being have.
Now, do you think that here in this country we should do more in schools to educate children about this?
Absolutely. In fact, I would like to see my book in every classroom because what's unique about this book, these were 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old kids. They were girls, just like the girls that are in junior high and high school, and they survived this. And so this book will teach parents and children, you know, how these predators think. What are their grooming behavior? How they groom these kids? How they ingratiate themselves and get the kids, you know, to look up to them because they're such power figures.
Mm-hmm.
It will teach them how to survive, how to save their lives if something like this were to occur. And it's, most importantly, it's going to teach parents how to protect their children from allowing this to occur.
I want we've got just a couple of minutes left there, but what I wanted to do is ask you. Now, is this up on Amazon, or how can people buy this, or how can school?
They can buy it at Amazon.com.
Or if you
can also go to my website at thebracelettenovel.com.
Okay.
And it's all one word, so it's thebracelettenovel.com, or go to Amazon.com.
And I want to mention that this book is actually, you have it on sale at $9.99, which I think is great, and it's about a 250-page. Look, it's a small size book, which is perfect for the schools, which is similar to what a lot of the schools order, you know, for their reading. And I think I tell you.
Well, we recommend that people read it.
I would recommend it. I would recommend that adults read it first, okay, and then give it to their kids to read, and then I would recommend it to them to bring it up to their PTOs or PTAs and suggest the book as critical reading, okay, for this kind of things. Because I believe it does tell a very, very serious story, and it's a critical.
And we thank you. We thank you very much for exposing this, and we hope you keep on talking about it with the media, so it does become the focus.
Right. And I also wanted to mention that you also do. Public lectures. You expand this project here. And I, how do people reach you?
They can reach me on my email at cbonner799@aol.com. Or again, they can go to my webpage, thebracelettenovel.com, and all of my contact information is there. And one last comment, even though this is a fictionalized story, it's based on true facts. So as they refer to in Truman Capote's book, it is true fiction. So, and I did it that way so that we would have real live facts so that parents and children and all of us can understand what the facts are, how we can protect the children based on the facts.
It's an interesting tale, and it's a very, very good book. It reads well, very fast, and I recommend it out there to everybody. I think it does a great service.
Thank you. And
I wish you well.
Maybe
we can have you. We're running out of time, but I'd like to. Maybe we can have you back in next month or so.
Please have me on any time. I'd be delighted to be on your show. I'm quite honored. and absolutely thrilled that you're taking on this subject and doing a great public service.
Well, thank you,
Charles, and keep on talking about it.
Yeah.
Thank you, I will.
Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
That was Charles Bonner, the author of The Bracelet, talking about sex slavery in the world, what a problem it is.
You can get it,
you can go to charles@thebraceletnovel.com. And that's where you can get it, or you can get it up on Amazon.
It's an interesting book, guys, and it's very inexpensive and ideal. He's not gonna die. Lila's getting so nervous.
We're about ready to go to our segment of the show.
Yeah.
But it's a worthwhile. This book is a worthwhile read. So, and Leo is going to move into
the
ring with
zone.
Woody. So if you would just. Put on music.
I get nervous there. We will get there. We always do. Thank everybody for listening tonight. That was Charles Bonner and The Bracelet, a novel. You can get that on Amazon. Tune in to us tomorrow night, and we tackle, I'm not really sure what we're going to tackle, but we'll be tackling some more stuff tomorrow. Hope you enjoyed the show, and see you then.